He made the trek to the Bell Strait and stared out at seawater that represented the most direct route to Europe for ships coming from either the St. Lawrence Seaway or Great Lakes ports. Yet fogs, gales, and ice-choked seas for 10 months of the year made navigation here some of the most treacherous in the world. The strait could hold wondrous sights, too, however. These included humpback whales doing spectacular flips, and wandering icebergs calved from glaciers in Greenland and bundled south by the Labrador Current before starting to come apart, with massive crashes, into the warmer waters off the coast. And Belle Isle, after which the strait was named, meant beautiful island. It sat at the eastern tip of the waterway and was roughly halfway between Labrador and Newfoundland, which together formed the Canadian province of the same name. Beauty in the midst of nothing, thought Kuchin. He believed, however briefly, that he'd found beauty in Provence, a woman who intrigued him, bewitched him even, one whom he thought he might like to possibly entertain for longer than one night, without a bloody mess to clean up afterward. And yet the beauty had almost killed him. It was a sense of betrayal, even though realistically the woman owed him no measure of loyalty, that fueled Kuchin's smoldering rage. He walked up to the top of a small knoll, the strait behind him and the land in front of him, flat for as far as the eye could see. Newfoundland was known as the Rock. Its eastern region used to be part of northern Africa. The last glaciation had scraped almost all the soil off the southeastern coast, leaving it with more rock than anything else, hence the nickname. Labrador, the easternmost section of the Canadian Shield, had roughly 3 times the landmass of Newfoundland, though with approximately 5% of its population. Its climate was technically classified as polar tundra, and polar bears, indeed, prowl the coastal areas, and caribou outnumbered people by over 20-1. Here, Kuchin had his pick of massive mountains to hike, isolated bays in which to fish, barren tundra to ski across, and breathtaking and brutal fjords cut into bedrock by glacier saws. The slopes were often sheer, and the current in the water deceptively fast. Kuchin drew a bead with his rifle, sighting through a scope manufactured by Zeiss, the same outfit that had supplied the Third Reich. It had everything an experienced shooter would expect in a high-end sighting device, including O-ring seals and nitrogen fill for fog proofing, all in a lightweight package with enhanced field of vision. When hunting large game, it was generally agreed that a minimum of 1,000 foot-pounds of force from the round was necessary. For the biggest game, like moose, that requirement ratcheted up to roughly 1,500 foot-pounds at about 500 yards. He was using pointed, boat-tailed, 140-grain rounds that would drop just about anything on 4 hooves, and certainly anyone on 2 feet. Kuchin had had this rifle custom-built. It was lightweight for ease of carrying and maneuverability, and he had fought his ego and opted for somewhat less power because that translated to less recoil, which resulted invariably in greater accuracy. He had splurged on a premium barrel because that played a major factor in the only thing that mattered, whether you hit your intended target or not. The small coyote was wandering along about 200 yards away from him, its agile gait carrying the animal along rapidly over the flat terrain. It was early for the beast to be searching for food, thought Kuchin, but here one never knew. Kill when you can was probably a good motto for such a desolate place. It was probably a female, Kuchin noted as he examined through the glass the small chest and frame of the animal. He lay prone on the ground, carrying the weight of the weapon on his elbows. He steadied himself, fixing his grip around the stock and underbelly of the gun, but relaxing his muscles. This was the magic recipe of the successful sniper and long-range hunter, firm but loose, heartbeat and breaths mellow, unhurried, but with any possible vibration removed. The butt of the weapon hard to his bicep, his index finger dropped to the trigger guard, and from there to the slender bit of curved metal. With one pull, the immediately heated round would burst from the elongated barrel, lands and grooves branded into its metal hide from the force of the rapid expulsion. The quarter-gram metal missile would cover the distance between man and beast roughly 6 times faster than if it had been perched in a seat on a commercial jet aircraft. And yet with the coyote dead in his sights, Kuchin did not pull the trigger. He lowered the weapon. The beast, unaware of how close it had come to annihilation at the hands of a far more dangerous predator, scampered along until it was nearly out of sight. Kuchin trudged the solitary miles back to his cabin. He had never enjoyed killing wildlife. Fishing held little interest for him either, despite having been his father's trade. It was only living things that looked like him that had ever motivated Fader Kuchin to pull the trigger, light the match to the gas-filled pits, kick out the stool from under the noosed victim, or plunge the knife in someone's chest. It was just who and what he was. He returned to his cabin, slid the parka on a hook by the door, locked his rifle back up in his gun safe, and returned to his desk. There was a blinking light on his phone. The message on the recording dispelled all the bad thoughts Kuchin had been harboring for most of the day. It was Alan Rice. "We found him."